Welcome to our paranormal afterlife. This is our paranormal afterlife, and I'm your host, Simon Bound. I have a new website. It is simonbound.com. That's Bound, not Brown. It replaces the Past Lives Hypnosis website, and you can go to this new website, the Past Life Regression, as well as info on my books and podcasts. This week, J.M. Debord returns to talk about his book, The Science of the Paranormal, The Truth Behind Telepathy, ESP, Reincarnation, and More Mysterious Phenomena. J.M., thanks for coming back to the podcast.
Thank you, Simon, for having me back. And I've been looking forward to this conversation. You have so many great questions, and it really gets into the meat of what I wrote about in the book. So let's dive right in.
Well, the book is The Science of the Paranormal, The Truth Behind Telepathy, ESP, Reincarnation, and More Mysterious Phenomena. We were talking about the Polly effect before we started recording. What's happening there?
Yeah. So I have a curse that follows me around everywhere. It's the curse of bad audio despite trying. Yeah, it's the curse of technology failing despite doing everything in my power to try to keep that from happening. So what happened this morning was, you know, we get on Zoom and we're starting to talk, and I realize I can't hear you through my headphones. And the, you know, I have a Razer Barracuda with a direct line into the computer. The audio should be fine. Zoom was showing the audio is coming through the headset, but then it kept defaulting back to the speakers. Now, everybody has glitches once in a while with technology. You know, that's just part of life, I guess. But it happens so often to me that I'm suspecting that I'm actually generating a field like Wolfgang Pauli, who is the, you know, the man, the name behind the Pauli effect. He was a quantum physicist who had developed a reputation for experiments failing of when he was around because he generated such an intense field. He was one of the most brilliant physicists, probably scientist people of the 20th century, and won the Nobel Prize, all that kind of stuff. People said he had this really intense personality and that it was so intense that things would fail around him. And so his colleagues at Princeton started forbidding him from their laboratories when they had sensitive experiments going on, because it was bound to fail. You know, like some piece of technology is going to blow up. A very sensitive, delicately, you know, set up experiment is just inexplicably going to fail at the last second because Wolfgang is in the room. So they actually forbade him from entering into their laboratories when they were running sensitive experiments, because he could create this. Apparently, he created some kind of a field around him. And when he would react to things, especially skeptically, like it would actually make things fail. And, you know, in the literature, they're showing that there is this type. They think maybe James Randi was one of these people who was so sharply skeptical that he actually made experiments fail because of his own effect that him being in the room would have on those experiments. So I'm thinking that I have my own little version of the Pauli effect, because I've had so many times that I'll prepare for something like this, a podcast interview, and then at the last second, all the technology goes haywire on me. And then what that does is it makes me stressed before going into the interview, and I can't just be relaxed and enjoy myself and have a great conversation. There's this like hit in my stomach that gets all twisted up because I'm like, my God, it happened again. You know, how many times can you have, you know, something set up perfectly, at least as far as you know, and then have it fail at the last second because of some glitch in the matrix? So, yes, the Pauli effect. But we got to have a new name now, Simon. What do you call it the Jason effect.
Yeah.
Audio fails inexplicably. But we have me on the phone now, and that way, you know, I can hear you, you can hear me, and it's going to work. And the audio won't be as great as it would be if I was wearing the headset because it has the nice microphone on it. But as long as, I guess as long as we get the ideas across and share this knowledge and information, then we'll consider it mission accomplished.
Let's talk about electronic stuff and spirit contact. I wanted to talk to you about Marcello Bacci, because I've seen some video of him on YouTube, and it was just amazing. Can you tell us what he was doing?
Well, he set up radios, modified them so that he could communicate to the other side through the, you know, through the technology. This is commonly known as instrumental transcommunication, or ITC. There is another term for it that is sometimes used, but ITC is what I find most often in the literature. You know, some people just call it spirit boxes, but if you equate some of the things you can buy on Amazon, hey, you can talk to the other side through our white noise generator, you know, it might sound a little scammy, you know, if you just follow that. But Bacci did some really, he did experiments in front of groups of people with verification of things like, you know, it's not, and there's no hidden technology that's making these voices come through the speakers or whatever they're using, you know, for the audio to, obviously you'd have to have some kind of speakers in order for a room full of people to be able to hear what was being transmitted from the other side through the technology. It's very highly suggestive. It sounds like some, you know, bad YouTube channel until you actually read the experiments and, you know, the accounts from the people who were there and the publications that came out from it. I mean, it didn't make it into the journal Nature or IEEE or something like that. But from what I could see, they set up good experiments and they repeated this hundreds of times, where it were even times when the voices kept coming through the speakers after they had unplugged everything. You know, they turn off the power to all the electronics that's, you know, these radio electronics and speakers and stuff. And they would even pull the power. In one of them, I remember they even pulled the valves out. This was back in the day when your radios and amplifiers were driven by these tube valves for, you know, the power source inside of them. And they even pulled the tubes out. And the voices continued to come through. So what would happen is that he would get into Bacci, and the others who've used ITC would basically just start asking questions of the other side. Like, is anybody out there? You know, kind of starting off with that, and then just wait until there was a sort of tune in to someone or a group of someone's, not always just one person that they're communicating with, but they might be communicating with groups. And they had, and it would start coming through. It would come through in different languages. Like, it would come through in the language of the person that they're trying to reach. They could be in Spain, but the person that they're trying to reach had been Italian, you know, and they're on the other side now. And then they would hear Italian coming through their speakers. It would in direct, you know, in answer to questions that they would ask, you know, who are you? And then they would hear a name and it would be the person that they're trying to contact, you know, where are you? And you would hear something like, you know, oh, I'm in the afterlife. You know, so it was really fascinating experiments. And it was used by Jeffrey Mishlove in his essay on that won him the Bigelow Prize. Are you familiar with that, Simon?
Yeah, I interviewed Jeffrey Mishlove about his essay.
Okay. Yeah. So, you know, he won the Bigelow Prize for that, which turned out to be a lot of, you know, I mean, $500,000 prize for writing the best essay with what he considered to be the best evidence for the continuation of consciousness. And the ITC, we'll just call them experiments, were part of what Jeffrey cited. And that led me down the rabbit hole, because to that point, I really hadn't considered that to be what you might call the good evidence. But I thought, well, if Jeff is citing this, then I should go ahead and do my research on this. I should get further into this. And because it has a bad reputation because of, like, you know, bad YouTube channels where people are, you know, talking to spirit boxes and stuff, and you hear nothing but, like, you know, static and stuff. And they're like, oh, it's my grandma talking from the other side. And you're like, no, you have a white noise generator that, you know, it sounds to me like you're imposing pattern on randomness because you have a preconceived idea of, you know, about how this stuff works. But then when I actually read the research and some of the accounts from people who were involved in the experiments, I was quite impressed. How about you? Have you listened to any of the recordings of the people coming through from the other side?
I have. I've watched, there was an old black and white film that was on YouTube, and it seemed like there was all these people in this room listening to this radio, and they recognized the voices. It wasn't just a voice that came through and gave information. People in there were saying, that's my husband's voice. It was a lot more evidential, I think, like that.
There was another case that I cited in the book about, I will say his name is Raudiv.
Yeah.
When he came through, there were actual images that came through on the television, and he had, a friend had received kind of a telepathic message from him saying, you know, when my funeral's going on, you know, and the friend couldn't be there. Like, it was in, you know, they couldn't travel to this other country. He was Italian, I think. And to be able to attend his funeral. And they had gotten this message saying, tune your television to channel something or another during my funeral. You'll see something spectacular. And it was clear as day. I mean, it wasn't just some fuzzy image. When you put, they took a Polaroid of what they were seeing on their television, which was at, seemed like a live transmission from, you know, TV studio heaven, you know, like, and you see this face and you put it together next to the picture of Raudiv, and you go, my goodness, it's so exact that it's hard to say that it wasn't him. And you have to fall back on, well, it must have been a hoax or something, which it wasn't. Raudiv did a lot of experiments over decades with using technology like spirit boxes to talk with the other side, and so he made it his lifelong work to experiment with this technology and then to provide evidence that it actually works. So for someone to then try to pull a hoax based off of that work would really be it would be disrespecting the legacy that he left. So I found those cases to be very compelling, because there was actually a recording somebody did where they used the technology, as somebody alive on Earth used the technology to contact Raudiv on the other side. And I've never heard something so clear. Usually these spirit box communications, like I was kind of joking earlier, it's, you know, fuzzy, lots of white noise. You know, it sounds like radio stations kind of coming in and out and signals mixing and crossing and stuff. I had none of that. It was clear as day. It was him identifying who he is and then having a conversation with the person on the other side. So it's, you know, I mean, in the end, if you look at it as somebody who's interested in the science of this, you would say, well, it either happened the way that it happened or it was an elaborate hoax. And the thing is that over and over again, as you go through this literature, this massive body of evidence that's been published in experiments that have been run, and sometimes maybe not so much published like in academic papers, but in books by the researchers, you either say there is a hoax going on a level that is staggering because it involves thousands of people over decades of time who are putting their reputations on the line by, you know, talking about what they've witnessed in their experiments. And they're all in on the hoax, or the evidence that they're gathering is truly showing that there is, they are truly capturing evidence of phenomena that are not well understood scientifically, but nonetheless, the evidence is there.
And have you seen Sonia Rinaldi's work with the pictures and videos she brings up?
Yes. And she's continues to do that work. In fact, I think I saw her on Jeffrey's show to talk about her on New Thinking Aloud to talk about some of that. I'm not an expert in it, you know, but I did cite some of that work in my book.
So I wanted to also talk to you about the Global Coherence Project. That's been going for a long time, hasn't it?
Yeah, since the mid to late 90s. You know, Simon, what a lot of people don't know when they hear about something like a subject like the science of the paranormal, if you come at it from the sort of what the average person has heard about, they would think that there's been no good science, that respected researchers, academics, professors wouldn't touch this stuff with a 10-foot pole. That's the impression that's been created. But when you actually dig into something like the Global Consciousness Project, you find that there was a Princeton engineering lab that was behind it. And the one of the principal researchers is Roger Nelson, who a PhD out of Princeton. But it also involved people like Brenda Dunn and Robert Johns. Robert Johns was the dean of engineering at Princeton. Very highly respected before he decided to touch the third rail in academic research, which was to, you know, explore the paranormal. But the GCP was an experiment set up where there are random number generators that are placed in positions around the world, and they feed information into a server at Princeton that keeps track of all this second by second. The random number generators are the equivalent of a coin flip. You're going to get heads or tails. You're going to get, you know, zero or one, and it's recorded. Now, we know if you sit there and flip a coin, you know, 100 times, that the average is going to be 50 heads, 50 tails. It'll, in real practice, though, it'll deviate. The average will be somewhere between, say, 42 and 58. What they were looking for with the random number generator, with the Global Consciousness Project, they were looking for deviations and to see if those deviations in the random number generators, the numbers generated, would coincide with mass global events. And sure enough, it did. During the funeral of Princess Diana, you know, there were hundreds of millions of people around the world who tuned in to, you know, to see her casket go down the procession way. And, you know, it was an event that was very much tied together. It generated a lot of emotion. And some of the random number generators started showing coherence. So they're not spitting out, seemingly they're not spitting out random numbers anymore. I mean, the random number generator is still generating random numbers. But what's happening is that there's now patterns developing in those numbers that suggests that it's no longer just random. So instead of falling between 42 and 58, you're now starting to get these series of coin flips, we'll just call them digital coin flips, that are going way outside of that range. So they did this, they basically left these number generators just running. They've been now running for 30 years. But there was something that happened on the morning of September 11th, primarily in New York, but, you know, Washington, D.C., Pennsylvania, the planes took off from Boston, some of them did. That was, of course, the September 11th attacks. And about 4 hours before the first plane struck, which would be about the time that this attack went operational, you know, like they're now getting to the airport and, you know, everything is falling into place to make this thing happen, the randomness started disappearing from the numbers, and they tracked quite dramatic changes that happened. And it continued throughout the morning as people tuned into their televisions and everybody was, you know, their attention, their consciousness was taken in by these events. They, the random number generators started showing patterns and deviations from the norm that suggested there was some type of a mass event. Now, these things don't happen. They run the number generators all the time, and they are always working, except for these rare occasions when there's these events going on globally or sometimes locally. They'll have a, you know, like at a concert or something like that. They could have a number generator that's nearby. So the generators that are in London are not necessarily picking up the event that's happening in Los Angeles because there's a big concert going on. But the number generators in Los Angeles are picking it up in these deviations from the norm. But they leave these generators running all the time, and just constant stream of data that come in. And they have shown that during times of emotional events that many people tune into or participate in, the random number generators will deviate from random. And it suggests that there is some kind of a global consciousness, something that connects us subconsciously and registers on the physical world. Like, it's not just stuff that's happening in our minds, that our minds are, and especially our hearts, generate some kind of a field that reaches out into the environment around us, which would include the people in the environment around us, and they would, you know, be affected by this. So one person's emotional reaction feeds another person's emotional reaction, feeds another person's emotional reaction. And the more people that you get who are kind of in that same field of energy, the stronger that field becomes and the more easily it can be picked up. So yeah, the GCP was a really fascinating project. And as far as I know, it's still ongoing.
So you mentioned 9/11, and there are also people who had premonitions of it, weren't there? Had dreams of 9/11 before it happened.
Yeah, and this is where some of the evidence gets really interesting, because the some of those premonitions were shared publicly with timestamps, you know, like server timestamps and stuff. There were a number of people that had dreams. There was an artist in New York or New Jersey who wrote, I think, on their blog about it. And you can go back and see the timestamp. Sometimes the imagery, when you look at the body of evidence, like all the different accounts, you'll see sometimes that the imagery appears to be metaphorical. There was a school kid from, he was an immigrant from Pakistan, whose school was right on the, right across from the World Trade Center complex in New Jersey. He apparently, from his classroom, he had a view across the bay of the World Trade Center. And the day before the attacks, he said that he had a dream about a soccer ball being kicked between two soccer posts, and that the posts were then crumbled and fell to the ground, which really does look like a metaphor for the towers crumbling and falling before our eyes. So there were instances like that where it appeared to be metaphorical. But then there were some of the others, especially the dreams that appeared to show the event very closely accurate to what happened. Basically, planes flying into the towers and the towers falling to the ground. Mass chaos, you know, mass death, things like that. So, yeah, this was one of those events that was apparently foreseen ahead of time. By dream or through vision. And, you know, it's not the kind of thing that you could necessarily publish, you know, because trying to prove something like that is very difficult to bake it to the standards of science. But I have seen that some of the predictions, the premonitions that people had were reported publicly before the event happened. This wasn't people making stuff up after the fact to whatever, get attention or try to, you know, proclaim themselves to be some kind of seer or something like that. These were real people who had real things happen to them, and they were so affected by it that they wanted to talk about it or at least share it. I've had this happen at Reddit, at the Dreams subreddit, where I'm, you know, I've been a moderator for years there and just a member of the community. And I keep my eye out for the more unusual posts, you know. And every once in a while, you'll get someone who'll come in and say, hey, I had a really specific dream about this specific thing that's going to happen at this specific place around this specific time. And then it ends up happening. Now, more often than not, it doesn't. And those aren't the cases that we hear much about because there's nothing there to sensationalize. Oh, you know, I had a dream that this town was devastated by, a nuclear device going off or something. And it was so realistic. You know, I think it's really going to happen. They might even be like, hey, if you live in this town, this city, you know, get out now, evacuate, you know, like they're so convinced that it's going to happen. And then, I mean, it doesn't, you know, but I did have somebody who reported a dream about an earthquake in South America, and they were specific down to like where it was, where the epicenter of it would be. And it was so specific, and the earthquake actually happened. And I was talking with the person about it, and I was like, you know, that's kind of an obscure place where it happened, down in South America. Are you located down there? And they said, no, I'm not located down there. I'm like, well, why then? You know, usually people who have these premonitions about a disaster happening have some kind of connection to that place. So I kept asking questions, and it turned out that that area of South America was where their ancestors were from. It's like, oh, so even though you're living in, say, Canada, you know, and this happens down, you know, in South America, many thousands of miles from where you are, you picked up this information supposedly, or we could hypothesize that they picked up that information about something that didn't have any direct effect on them. It's not like this was their hometown. It's not like this is where their relatives lived, you know, and now, you know, like all those people are involved in the earthquake. A lot of premonitions happen for that reason, that, you know, people who you love are involved in some kind of a major event, whether something personal that happens to them, you know, a car accident, a health crisis, death, or involves the area where they're in, something like an earthquake, a tornado. They didn't have any connection to it, but then we found out that their ancestors had hailed from that area of the world, and then it started making more sense to me why they had such a specific dream about that earthquake just before it happened.
Hello, Simon here. I conduct past life regression sessions over Zoom. Have you ever felt a pull toward a place, a person, or a pattern in your life that you just can't explain? Past life regression can be a deeply healing and insightful experience, helping you explore the stories, emotions, and connections that may be shaping who you are today. Whether you're seeking clarity, emotional release, or a deeper understanding of your soul's journey, a session can open the door to powerful personal insight. To find out more or to book a session, visit simonbown.com. Hello, Simon here. Could we move on to reincarnation?
Well, I know that's a subject that you really like, so yes, let's talk about reincarnation.
You've got stuff about Jeffrey Keane and his reincarnation.
Well, first, Jeff is a friend of mine, but he wasn't a friend before I found out. It was through the research that I did, but I already knew Jeff because he's a member of the reincarnation community at Reddit, and I'm a moderator of that community. So when I was accumulating evidence, the scientific research into reincarnation, I wanted to include more than just the dry science of it, you know, because there have been a lot of studies done. And surprisingly, there's extraordinary evidence for reincarnation that has been published, gathered scientifically, goes through all the academic rigor, and has been, you know, and it has been published mostly through the University of Virginia and the Department of, or the Division of Perceptual Studies there. But I also wanted to include some of these accounts from people who, what happened to them is so extraordinary that the skeptical opinion would be that it's either like some kind of, the people are basically deluding themselves into thinking that some experience that they had is evidence that they'd had a past life. So let me explain Jeffrey's case. Jeff is, or was, he's a retired fire chief in a smaller town in Connecticut. He was, by all accounts, he was very good at his job, very serious about making sure that people get out alive. You know, I mean, it's a serious job. You show up where there's fires and you direct a team of people to go and put those fires out. So it's dangerous and it's important. You know, there's lives at stake. And Jeff took his job with appropriate seriousness. Now, I know these kinds of people. I've rubbed elbows with, you know, the police and paramedics and firefighters and stuff like that. These are not people who are prone to fantasy, you know, or to making stuff up or to making themselves believe things that aren't true. Not to say that there aren't people out there who are in those professions who are like that. But if you met Jeffrey, you would be like, yeah, he fits the archetype. You know, he was a very serious type of person who stepped right into his own reincarnation. I mean, literally, he was on a sort of a vacation and they were touring. He was with his wife and they were touring Civil War battlefields. And there was the battlefield at Antietam that was right down the road. And his wife was like antiquing or something. So he's like, hey, I'll be right over here. I'm going to go check out the Civil War battlefield. And he said that he was walking along and he stepped on a spot on the ground and it knocked him, like his body reacted so strongly that it knocked him to the ground. So he's, you know, he's like thinking he's having a heart attack or something. You know, this totally unexpected thing just happened to him. And he's, you know, he's wondering what's going on because it was such a strong physical reaction. Well, to make a long story short, Jeff, at that moment, had just stepped over the ground where a man named General Gordon, He was a Civil War general for the Confederacy. And he had been standing on that spot when he was shot through the face during a Civil War battle. It took Jeff a while to figure out the connection, but once he saw who General Gordon was, you know, that like he went and read the man's diaries, he got the history of him. Gordon went on to become like a governor after the war. He was a very high, I mean, obviously a general during the war. He's a person of authority, you know. Jeffrey had never heard of him before. Then he went on to be, I think it was governor of Alabama. So he had a long career as a, you know, a public figure and a public leader. But he really should have died that morning, because that getting shot through the face was the last of the wounds that he took. He had got shot like six times that day. And the one that tore through his face was the one that should have killed him. He spent the rest of his life with, you could see the scars where he was shot. When Jeffrey went and looked in the mirror, he saw the same patterns on his own face. And you can see it in the picture that I published in the book. You can see the two men side by side. They are identical, almost. I mean, little differences, variations. One had a longer mustache, you know, the other had a, you know. But you can see where the scars are, where on General Gordon's face and then on Jeff's face. There were so many things that lined up that between the two men. Jeffrey was convinced, and he was the subject, that he really was General Gordon. It wasn't something where it was just like an instant, oh yeah, you know, I'm the reincarnation of this, you know, Civil War general. Like, no, 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 no. It took a long time and a lot of convincing for him. He was very skeptical about all of this, but he kept encountering information that suggested that he was the reincarnation of Gordon, including the job he did and the way that he went about it was just, you know, that sort of like you're a leader of people and you're taking them into dangerous situations. And you better gut check yourself before you do this. Is this something that you're really cut out for? And are you able to lead people into these situations where life and limb is at stake? So as a fire chief and also presumably as General Gordon, you have that same personality coming to bear. I read Jeffrey's book, Fire in the Soul, and there were many other things that he talks about that didn't necessarily make it into my book, The Science of the Paranormal. But I found it to be one of those cases that was so convincing because it happened to somebody who was very skeptical about the whole subject and did not have reincarnation on the radar. And I forget what religion Jeffrey is, whether it's Catholic or Protestant, you know, but I can tell you this, it's not Hindu or Buddhist where these beliefs are accepted widely, you know, the belief in reincarnation. In fact, in the cultural and religious upbringing, there's actually a lot of pressure against believing in any of this stuff. When I first encountered reincarnation, I remember my first thought was, it's a Buddhist thing. You know, I was in my early 20s or so. Not that I hadn't heard of it before then, but just where I first seriously considered whether it was a real thing. And I thought, well, there's a lot of Buddhists who think it is. But in my, you know, Christian Protestant upbringing, there is, you know, reincarnation as a, believing in reincarnation as a sort of heresy. You know, it's just not something that people do. And if they do believe it, then they don't talk about it because it runs against popular beliefs. So, Jeffrey, I thought, was one of those cases that I wanted to bring forward because, for one, I've talked with him for hours and hours about these subjects, and he has never wavered in his own story about what happened to him. He's been very consistent about that. The numbers of coincidences are extraordinary that made him be on that battlefield that day to walk across the very ground where he had almost died and then have the visceral physical reaction when that happened to him to the point where he thought he was having a heart attack. if Jeffrey was the only case, then you could say, yeah, I suppose there could be some really extraordinary coincidences. He just happened to have a minor cardiac event when he was walking across that piece of ground. But there are many cases where this has happened to people, and they end up with the same conclusion, you know, that the information that they're getting through some kind of subconscious source, that initial blast that says, you know, you are now connecting back through time with yourself from a previous incarnation, the visceral reaction that you have when that connection is made, is pretty extraordinary evidence, I think. But you put it together with the body of evidence that the many cases where this has happened, including Detective Bob Snow, which is one of the most fascinating cases, the portrait of a past life skeptic. But then there's also the evidence that the phenomenon exists in the first place. You know, to say that there is some kind of evidence for reincarnation presupposes that there is such a thing as reincarnation. And you want to show the evidence for that, you know, to show that it is. There is this evidence that it really is a real phenomenon. And that came through the researchers at the University of Virginia, primarily Ian Stevenson and Jim Tucker, both PhD. Jim Tucker is a child psychologist. I believe that, if my memory serves me correct, so was Ian Stevenson. Most people don't know that there was a division that was founded down there to study this stuff. They were given a large endowment to create a department chair, which first was chaired by Ian Stevenson and then was chaired by Jim Tucker. And they were given the funds to be able to travel around the world and go and investigate cases that appeared to have potential to yield good evidence for reincarnation through the memories that are reported by young children. You know, some as young as 2, 3, maybe 4, 5, 6, 7 years old, who start talking about details of past incarnations with extraordinary detail. And then Ian or Jim would come along and investigate, like, can you track down who they were in a past life? Can you actually, like, if they say, you know, well, my name was Joe, and I grew up in, you know, the Tallahassee, Florida, on this street, and my mom's name was this, and my dad's name was that, and I died when I was 7 years old when, you know, I was chasing a ball out in the middle of the street and was hit by a car. And they can, you know, they remember extraordinary details. This is a 4 or 5-year-old child who's talking about things very specific. So people write down the evidence, they write down all these details, and they go and they try to find if there was someone named Joe who lived in Tallahassee, Florida, who was 7 years old and, you know, got hit by a car. And some of these cases, well, 2,700 cases, they were able to verify as best they could that to trace the identity, to find the past life incarnation in historical records and make the connections with them between the current person, you know, usually this child who has reported these past life memories, and the historical evidence. And they've done it 2,700 times. Is it perfect? I mean, it's never going to meet the bar for hard science, but we're not talking about hard science here. Does it meet the evidence, like the criteria for social science? Did they do their due diligence? Did they follow, you know, the protocols, then the methods that would, you know, so that other researchers can reproduce their work? They did. And it's why this evidence is still to this day holds up as probably the best body of evidence for reincarnation, because of the numbers of cases. I mean, there were 27, last time I looked, there were 2,700 verified cases. They took the top 10% of those. There was a researcher, I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but he did more of what would be called a meta-analysis. He took the best 10% of the cases and ran them through the most rigorous sorts of fact-checking and statistical analysis that you possibly could. They were looking for any flaw in this. They said, can you present cases that are airtight? And they were able to, and about 10% of these where they said, there is absolutely nothing that we can find about these cases that would give a researcher pause about the way that the evidence was gathered. You may not like the subject. You may not like the idea that reincarnation is a real thing. You may think that people are chasing fairy tales, but one thing you can't say is that it's bad science. I thought the reincarnation evidence was really extraordinary and that it had to be part of my book.
I was going to say, and past life regression gets criticized, but there are things that come up from past life regression that are verified, aren't there? And one of the things you have in your book is with Brian Weiss. He had two clients who did not know each other, but seemed to remember a life together.
Yeah, that was one of the cases that broke my mind open because it came from a psychiatrist who had been the head of psychiatry at Mount Sinai Hospital. You know, I mean, this is someone who, for one, demonstrated that they have the chops to be a top professional in their field. And then for two, somebody who had a reputation on the line. It's not just somebody with, you know, their YouTube channel making claims. And if they're proven to be wrong, it's not going to hurt them because they don't have anything to hurt. They don't have a reputation on the line. Brian very much did. I mean, Dr. Weiss, you know, and he had to give all that up because when he brought forward his evidence for reincarnation, he lost a lot of respect among his colleagues. His professional standing was in tatters when all was said and done. But he brought forth the truth as he knew it, and he felt so strongly about it that he had to do it. He had two patients who he was seeing at the same time, but separately. So in the same months that go by, he's seeing one during sessions, and then he's seeing another during at different times, different days. He said that he went back and checked his calendar, and these two had never encountered each other, like coming or going to that point. When they were in session with him, each, you know, they're seeing a therapist, so there's something going on in their lives that's led them to, you know, to see a professional for help. But we're not talking about psychosis or anything like that. We're talking about the things that people deal with in their lives, you know, the stresses and disappointments and, you know, things like that. So Brian took them into hypnotic regression, not to look for past lives. These are not past life regressions. He wasn't going into it with that intent. He was applying techniques of hypnosis to help to understand what was happening subconsciously that could be behind what, you know, some of the dysfunction that they were experiencing in their lives. By this point, he had started to get a little more into the past life regression, but, you know, he wasn't really going about it with that specific purpose when he started this. They started talking. So it's important to know that during the hypnosis sessions, they started spontaneously talking about, from their own point of view, a life that they had lived in Egypt, ancient Egypt, that had caused a lot of trauma. They were describing events that had happened thousands of years before recorded Egyptian history. Like, this was, you would be talking in the range of, you know, 5000 BC sort of time. Because some of the technology, they described healing technology that they used. Well, so the one man saw himself as this priest, and his sister was a priestess, and they were both in the healing arts. And they used these really extraordinary devices. It was rods filled with like a thick fluid, maybe some kind of mercury. And they talked about their, you know, advanced training to be able to do the healing work that they did. They had a child of a nobleman who came to him. His son was deathly sick and came to them to get healing, and they weren't able to do it. And that led to a rift between them and the nobleman, and it led to their exile. So they experienced this a traumatic event described in detail by these two patients who've never run across each other. The man and the woman both described these events, but from their own points of view, as if they were there, like that was one of their past incarnations. So, I mean, that would be extraordinary in itself if you, you know, like... It's not necessarily the kind of thing where you go, well, that's going to make a, you know, believer out of me. You know, it wasn't strong enough. But what happened next was where Brian said that it was just mind blowing. He said at one point that he started realizing that these two had been related by a past life, that they were there seeing him, because the things they were experiencing presently in their lives with the dysfunction, was actually the source of it was in that past life experience. And he's trying to figure out as the doctor how to navigate this without, you know, he needed things to happen organically, because when you try to orchestrate events that are happening through a larger sort of synchronicity, then it's doomed to failure. It has to unfold organically. And he said that he was doing things like trying to get them to encounter each other in his waiting room. Like the one would be getting done with the session and the other would be coming out. And he'd try to get it scheduled that way just to see if they lay eyes on each other, is something going to happen? If they have a chance to say hello in the waiting room, is something going to happen? Well, all of his attempts to do that all end up getting thwarted. And then both of them had something happen where they were going to have to leave Miami, where he was practicing at the same time. And they were first scheduled on different flights, but then one person's flight got rearranged and put them on the same flight. And then something happened where one of them had to change seats. So now they're sitting next to each other. And then while they're like taking off, like the plane starts, you know, hitting turbulence, like really bad turbulence. And it unconsciously, so they're now sitting next to each other on a plane. They don't, you know, they don't know each other yet, really. And the, you know, strangers on a plane hits turbulence, and they both brace themselves on the seat and their hands touched. And apparently that was like what Jeffrey Keane experienced when he stepped across the ground where he'd been shot as General Gordon. It sent a shock wave through their bodies when their hands touched. And so, yeah, he describes all of this in his book, Only Love is Real. And I thought, this is some of the most, if this is a coincidence, then it's beyond extraordinary. When you have so many things line up like that in such an exact way, it starts becoming kind of preposterous to try to say that it must have all been coincidence. So that's what opened my mind to reincarnation many years ago when I first read Dr. Weiss's book. And so since then, I've kind of been on an adventure to, you know, find as much of the evidence as I can. And of course, now I'm thoroughly convinced of it. But at first, I was like most people, and I thought reincarnation was just a, you know, a belief of people who don't know the one true Jesus, you know, like as a Christian, you know, or somebody brought up in a Christian culture, you know, who'd been to church and stuff like that and had absorbed the doctrines. I mean, reincarnation is very much talked against. It's thought of as just the hallucinatory fairy tales of millions or billions of people who are being deceived, which I'm now convinced that it's the other way around, and that there was a lot of evidence for reincarnation in the original writings of the Bible, but it's mostly been edited out. But that's a story for another time.
The book is called The Science of the Paranormal, The Truth Behind Telepathy, ESP, Reincarnation, and More Mysterious Phenomena. And people can get that on Amazon, can't they?
Yeah, Amazon and other booksellers. It was on bookshelves. It came out through a fairly, you know, large publisher. But it's been some months, so it's probably, you know, off of bookshelves by now. But yes, you can definitely get it through Amazon and, you know, your local bookstore probably could order it for you. And if anybody out there is really interested in seeing what the evidence is for the paranormal, what the science is behind it, and some of the really extraordinary characters who were involved in this, you know, we dropped some names here, you know, Jeffrey Keane and Brian Weiss and Ingo Swann, Alex Tanis. I think that it's interesting to learn about them as it is about the experiments that they were involved in and the science that they were involved in. So I think for anybody who's really looking for an overview of what is now 150 years of serious scientific research into the paranormal, that my book is probably perfect for them.
Fantastic. Right, but thanks again for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. You sent me such a great list of questions. I think we just barely scratched the surface, didn't we?
Yeah.
Hopefully we got to the best ones that you were, you know, hoping to talk about today.
This week, I was talking to J.M. DeBoard about his book, The Science of the Paranormal, The Truth Behind Telepathy, ESP, Reincarnation, and More Mysterious Phenomena. And my book, called Verified Near-Death Experiences, is on Amazon. And you can get it on paperback, audiobook, or Kindle. And a great way to support the podcast is to join Patreon, where you'll get access to the extended episodes. And if you enjoy the podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.